Thank you so much for being here, members and visitors alike. It's good to have you with us. We've been talking a little bit on Sunday mornings recently about the consequences that come with living in a world that puts less and less emphasis on God and things of God, how inevitably our culture is going to decline and ultimately even perish. And I want to talk about our sense of identity here for a little bit this morning. I was thinking about this in preparation for the lesson today, and it occurred to me that one of the easiest ways to look intellectual is to ask questions that have perfectly obvious answers, and then act like you're not satisfied when you get the answer. For instance, who are you? I'm Hal. Nice to meet you.
No, really. Who are you?
Well, I'm Hal Hammonds from Austin, Texas, the son of Harold and Doris, the husband of Tracy, father of Kylie Taylor, currently residing in Pensacola, Florida. I know all that.
Who are you?
Well, I mean, we can get into fingerprints and genetic material and all that kind of thing, I suppose, if we dig deep enough, but are we really profiting by any of this? And why do we bother with this kind of thing? Generally speaking, if people want to know who I am, I don't feel compelled to give them my social security number. In fact, I don't give them my social security number. I think the problem is that we, in our increasingly godless society, have an increasingly dissatisfied sense of worth and of value and of identity. Who are we, in fact? The fact is, God has given us an innate sense, this feeling, this compulsion, really, toward this conviction that we are greater than the sum of our parts. That we are not simply carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen. That we are not simply bone and skin and muscle and blood. That there is something else. Something greater than the sum of its parts. Something, dare I say, eternal. And something that a godless world can absolutely not account for. Cannot explain it at all. And I'm going to suggest to you here this morning that if you turn off the divine aspect of your life, if you persist in the notion that you are nothing more than what you see in front of you, then you are going to be profoundly dissatisfied with that. And if your culture persists in that kind of attitude, you're going to have consequences that are real and that are profound. And they're going to last for a lifetime. What is my identity, really? What is a human being? When we live in a God world, when we read our Bibles, we have an answer to this. I know when I read the Bible that I am a special creation. I am something different. I am something set apart. There is the plant world, and there is the animal world. There is the mineral world. There is the astrological world, or the astronomical world, if you will. And then there's me. I'm different from that. I am a human being, and it is a glorious thing. You may not think so when you look at me in the mirror, or look at yourself in the mirror. But in fact, being a human being is the most wonderful thing that could possibly be. Because we are the only thing in all of God's creation that is made in His image. This was the case from the very beginning. Now, I'm not going to try to keep from getting sidetracked into all kinds of rabbit trails that we can get into with regard to atheistic evolution and such things as that. The Bible teaches that from the very beginning, from day six, human beings were distinctly and markedly different from anything else that God had made. There was no gradual development from this into that. On day six, let us make man in our image. And that's exactly what God did. And being this special creation, being set apart from the rest of the world, we can have confidence that we are at the center of the universe. That everything is about us. I don't want to feed your egos too much here. And certainly we can take this too far. I'm not talking about you as an individual, especially. And maybe we're taking the passage a little bit out of context in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and verse number 21 and following, where Paul says, "So then let no one boast in men, for all things belong to you, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come. All things belong to you, and you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God." What he's saying here is that there are people there in Corinth who are limiting themselves to being disciples of Apollos, or being disciples of Paul, or being disciples of Cephas. And he says, that's inappropriate. You shouldn't be doing that. All things belong to you. Everything that God sent to you is yours, and you shouldn't short yourself with regard to that. But then, as he continues his analogy, he expands upon this. It's not just doctrinal things, it's everything. Everything that God ever made was made for human beings. Maybe the husbands have some experience with this. Or parents. I can remember how old were the girls? Little. Maybe Taylor was 7. Probably was 4 or something like that. And Tracy and I decided we were going to make this doll house. In fact, we did 2 of them. We assembled one that was pre-managed, pre-packaged, and looked really, really nice. And then one from scratch. We did this twice. Crazy. We did crazy things when we love our kids, right? Both times, we're just, this effort. And particularly, we have a card table in our garage right now that has paint stains on it. And the paint stains are coming from the setting of these dollhouses. They've been working on them for months. Get the girls to bed. Okay, go to bed. Night. Okay, look at the dollhouse. And we're glued. We're just painting this. It's this huge affair. Day before Christmas, the night before Christmas, 12 o'clock at night, we're out gluing shingles. Because we didn't want to give them a half-done dollhouse. We wanted it to be finished. Everything that we put into this was for them. And all the work and all the preparation and all the effort goes in ahead of time. And then they get the present. That's the way it works, right? That's what God does for human beings. That's why we came last. God made the world, and he made day and night, and he made plants and animals and oceans and rivers and all. Everything he made, and then he made man. Because it was for us that he made these things. And again, not to feed our egos too much as far as this goes, but human beings are marvelous creatures. Far more than anything else God has ever made. And we can get even better. Even better. Ephesians chapter 1, verse number 11 and 12, and other passages also talk about this, the perfecting that we engage in as we live our lives, not only as God's special creation, but as his special spiritual recreation. That God is doing things in us as we speak, if we'll allow it, if we'll permit this to happen. God is taking us to greater and greater levels. Verse 11, it says, also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to his purpose, who works all things after the counsel of his will, to the end that we who were the first to hope in Christ would be to the praise of his glory. We get hung up on this idea of being predestined sometimes. We ignore what a marvelous concept this is. We're not suggesting here that your life was foreordained. You're just simply walking in tracks that God has already prepared for you, that you're a train that's irrevocably going in a certain direction. You have no choice in the matter. That's not what predestination is. What we're simply saying is that God has a plan for you. And he's always had a plan. And that we are able to participate in this plan by our choice. And as we grow, as we develop, we become more and more like God wants us to be. And it's this incredible thing that only you and I can do. Dogs can't do this. Monkeys can't do this. Killer whales can't do this. The roses in your front yard can't do this. Only human beings. And when we take God out of this, when we stop thinking about ourselves in this way, when we're simply who we are and that's all, just matter, just intelligence, just whatever kind of morality we may be able to figure out for ourselves. If that's all that we are, without God, then we're left with what the atheists are telling us we are. We are simply a matter of random chance. I realize that there are reasons why that appeals to certain people. Moral reasons, hedonistic reasons, such as. I have to tell you, that concept sickens me, it terrifies me, it befuddles me. It is objectionable on every conceivable level. The idea that I just happen to be. It just came about, and not just me personally, of course, but all of us, and all this, in fact, but especially you and me. We have no intrinsic worth at all. We're left the way that the text said in Ezekiel chapter 13. We read this a few moments ago. And you probably were following along with the scripture that was up on the board. We were reading from Ezekiel chapter 5. And you're thinking, this is going to be a real picker-upper of a sermon. Right? Wow, that's real heart warmer there. You realize that much of Ecclesiastes is written in this tone. The idea of a life that is lived without God. A life that is lived separate and apart from any kind of consideration of spiritual things. If you're just you, just your atoms, just yourselves, if that's all there is, then what are you doing here? What purpose is any of it? We're no better than the dog. You can open doors, and the dog usually can't. Congratulations as far as that goes. But that's it. The dog's spirit goes one direction, the human being's spirit goes in another. Who's to say? Your life and the dog's life are exactly the same, as he says there in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Do you like thinking of yourself that way? Now, I appreciate that just because you are dissatisfied with a certain explanation, that doesn't mean it's not true. I get that. But aren't you inclined to believe that you're God's creation? All things being equal, if you had reason to believe that, wouldn't you want to believe that? Isn't that a vastly superior concept of yourself, of the world, of humanity? Especially when we consider what's happening in the world around us. When we look at our society, we see depression running rampant. We see jealousy and hatred and all kinds of personal animosity toward one another. I think this is why we see this. I don't think that our culture is where it is morally because we are poisoning ourselves with preservatives and frozen pizza and too much fat and starch and whatever the bill is these days, sugar, whatever. That may have a part in the difficulties that our physical bodies have. I wouldn't question that. But I don't believe for a moment that the rampant rise in depression and suicide and such things as that are a direct and inevitable result of the food we eat and the air we breathe and the water we drink. I don't believe that. I believe it's because we don't have God. Because we have abandoned the concept of who we actually are. If you don't think that you're special, in fact, if you have it drilled into your head from kindergarten and even before that you're not special,
What if it says you're going to believe it?
If I was told that I was an animal and nothing more, in fact, lucky to be an animal for 18 years, eventually I'd start acting like an animal,
wouldn't I?
Wouldn't you? Wouldn't the world? With God, we know who we are. We are His children, His special creation. And the more we embrace that, the better equipped we're going to be to find fulfillment in our life, find identity in our life, find purpose in our life. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we go. What is my nature, really? What is the essence of humanity? If you believe the Bible, if you believe what God is telling us in the Bible, you believe that you are what is called in some of our translations a living soul or a living being. We were, for practical purposes, mud, dirt. And God formed us out of the dirt. And then the text says in Genesis chapter 2, and verse number 7, that the breath of life was breathed into us. That's an amazing image when you think about it. I don't know if God had to do it this way. I suppose He didn't. I suspect that this was done so that we could understand not only the physical ramifications of this story, but also the spiritual ramifications. Because we go on to see a great deal of symbology around the idea of breath and breathing. We talk about God inspiring His prophets to teach His word. We talk about God giving us spiritual breath, as it were. That our existence on earth is impossible, let alone pointless, without the breath of life that God gives to us. It all comes back to this, doesn't it? In a literal and physical way, God caused us to come alive. He gave us something that did not exist before. He gave us life. And I think that there is an implicit in that, beyond physical life, spiritual life as well. A living soul, especially as it's rendered in some of our versions there, seems to indicate not just life in this physical body, but also a spirit, a spiritual existence that inhabits a physical body temporarily and then goes on to other things. Being a spiritual being, being a living soul, God gives us morality. God gives us decency. He gives us a code of conduct and hardwires it into our DNA. We try very hard sometimes to ignore this. But it's not difficult for us to prove that at our core, where we truly live, in our heart of hearts, human beings are moral beings. They don't always act like it. They don't always act in accordance with morality, but they are moral beings. I used to tell stories on the girls today, again. Both of our girls, when they were in kindergarten, I used to go and help. We had half-day kindergarten in Tulsa. And I would go in and pitch in for a couple of hours or so, and it was pretty interesting, you know, participating with the kids and such. And you hang around 5-year-olds for very long, and you probably have the same experience with 3 or 4-year-olds too. But especially 5-year-olds, when they're all in a big group, and they are supposed to line up for snacks. And they line up, and the big kid, instead of going to the back of the line, he cuts into the front of the line. How did the kids act? Teacher, he's cutting in line. So what? Well, that's not fair. Well, who says? Did the teacher say on day one, make sure that you don't cut in line? She probably did. But let me tell you this. If she didn't say that on day one, and a big kid cut in line on day one, the little kids would know that wasn't fair. Had they been taught that, I'm sure they probably have. But there is also a very real sense of decency and order and right and wrong that we come into this world with. We may not understand it when we're 6 months old, But it doesn't take long for us to realize you're supposed to be doing the right thing and not doing the wrong thing. We may be a little fuzzy on what the right thing is and what the wrong thing is. But we understand the concept. There is morality. God gave that to us. God made us that way. There are all these awful stories about what? We're dog people, we're not cat people. Part of the reason is we hear all these horror stories about what happens in cat families when the owners pass away. The cats have no loyalty to the owner. We'll just leave it at that. There's no morality in a cat. Now, how horrible it is alligators eat their own. That's awful. Why? You expect an alligator to be moral? That's ridiculous. Alligators aren't moral. Cats aren't moral. Plants and trees aren't moral. Human beings are moral. Romans chapter 1, verse 32, talking about the Gentile world, the world that by and large did not understand anything about the God of heaven, at least at the time of this writing. The text says that although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things, that is these awful things that he's talked about in the previous verses, those who practice such things are worthy of death. They not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. This is saying not only did these people know the difference between right and wrong, but they made a choice, a conscious, deliberate choice to ignore that and go in their own way instead of in God's way. Why is that? Because they rejected God in the first place. When you reject God, morality is next in line. There is no ultimate arbiter of who's right and who's wrong. Whose idea of right, whose idea of wrong is going to rule? In kindergarten, it's the teacher. That's easy. In life, it's a lot more complicated than that. If you don't have God to draw a line, a firm, direct, black line, who's going to do it? God gives us, beyond that, this sense of eternity. What a marvelous thing this is. And I think this is what the text means in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 10, where it says that he put eternity in our hearts. I think what he's saying is, and this is what I've believed and taught for a long time, that there is an innate sense in human beings, a sense of eternity, a sense of beyond this life. We don't always know how to pursue that. There are cultures that believe in reincarnation and such things as that. Uninformed, misinformed. But we know, regardless of what culture we're living in, we know that there is something beyond death. What happens then? We all want to know. And we are being told over and over again in our culture, our godless culture, nothing. Nothing happens after that. Oh, one of these days the sun will burn out. You know, billions of years in the future, the sun will all burn out and we'll all be gone. But that's not your problem. That's your grandchildren's problem. You just live, you die, and that's it. That's the world we're living in. Without God, if God is not part of this picture, all we're doing is we're just breathing. We're just changing oxygen into carbon dioxide. That's all we're doing here. That's all the consequence there is. Does that sound depressing? I'm trying to make it sound depressing. Because it's very depressing for me. I am an inconsequential cog in a system that does not need me. It existed before me. It'll exist after me. I do not matter. I may think I matter in the short term. If my friends need a fourth for golf or a ninth for baseball or whatever, then maybe I matter a little bit in a small little smidgen of life. But that passes. And eventually I'll pass. I told you this was going to be an upper, right? Is that the world you want to live in? Is that the world you want to believe in? And whatever little significance you may have ends when you die. It's over. There's no more me. We have memories. Even those will fade eventually. What if you get written about in the history books? What if you're George Washington or whatever? You may live for 500 years, you may live for 1,000 years, but it's going to end eventually. Even that's going to end.
Is it any wonder that in the absence of such things, in the absence of real, concrete morality, when people think that their life is simply from this point to this point, that you get a rampantly hedonistic kind of culture, one that feeds the moment, because the moment is all there is. It's all about what I can achieve, what I can do. And if I have to run over somebody else to do it, why not? What difference does it make? Me first. How many times have you, just in this last week, have you run into people, hopefully not literally, where they were doing something. And you know perfectly well that if someone else were doing it in their vicinity, they'd be furious. Why do all of our analogies immediately make us think about driving? They aren't just drivers though, right? People in Walmart, people at school, at work, whatever, doing horrible, horrible things because they feel like it. And if somebody else did it, we're going to war. Why? Because there's no God. Because we have abandoned a basic sense of decency. Why would you want to live in a world like this? The answer is a lot of people don't. This is where this comes from. Let me give you one more. What is my standing? Where do I stand? What is my verdict? As I read the Bible, as I approach the concept of identity, as I approach the concept of human beings from a biblical perspective, I come away with the constant message, the unending message, that I, as a human being, am a sinner saved by grace. Or, if I haven't been saved yet, in need of grace. We all fall short of the glory of God, every single one of us, before and after our salvation, if we are in fact saved. We continue to fall short. We are not what we ought to be. We are never going to be what we ought to be. That's where we stand. And if that's all there is to it, that's a pretty sad story. But as a matter of fact, it's not all that there is to it. Look over in Isaiah chapter 6. I left the verses off, but read with me in Isaiah chapter 6 and I'll go back to verse number 1. Isaiah is being called here. Called to prophecy. Called to service. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. Then I said, "Woe to me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." I hope and pray that's how I would react in the presence of that kind of holiness. When we as the people of God read the Bible, when we read about the God that we serve, and then we look in the mirror, and we look at ourselves, the holiness of God ought to absolutely put us to shame. We cannot stand before this. Not because we're particularly bad, particularly evil, worse than our neighbor or what. That's not it. No matter how well Isaiah seems to have been a very decent man. Godly man. A man who lived in the fear of the Lord. And he knew that he was not fit to be in the presence of this holiness. But then look what happens after this. Verse number 6. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven." And by the way, I'm glad God picked a different mechanism for forgiving my sins than touching my mouth with a burning coal. I'm just throwing that out there. This is a vision, of course, as Isaiah is saying here. He's not suggesting here that you forgive your sins by eating coals, burning or otherwise. He's saying that in our inadequacy, in our ugliness, God reaches out to us with mercy, and he forgives us. God brings us out of this pit that we have made for ourselves, and he brings us into this place of glory and wonder and fellowship that we could not possibly have carved out for ourselves, but that God makes for us because of his mercy. What a wonderful thing that is. That I can not only stand condemned before God, but also stand justified before God. And that is a concept that's far bigger than our time is going to permit here this morning. But we'll leave it at that. That God is willing and eager, in fact, to reach out to us. And then what happens? Verse number 8. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." Isaiah volunteers. Okay, great. Go. He said, "Go and tell this people. Keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of the people insensitive, their ears dull, and their eyes dim. Otherwise they may see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed." That's a strange message. Go out and preach to people who do not want to be preached to, and keep on preaching. Why would you do that? Why would you preach to people who are not only lost, but who seem to appreciate being lost, revel in being lost? That's what Isaiah wants to know. "Lord, how long?" Verse number 11. Bear down on this. And he answered, "Until cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land." Bad, bad stuff, in a nutshell. "Yet, there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will be again be subject to burning like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." And the rest of Isaiah really goes on to talk about this stump. About the opportunity for life in the midst of death, in the midst of disaster. And whether you're talking about the nation of Israel as a whole, whether you're talking about humanity as a whole, or you're talking about Hal Hammonds, it's the same thing, basically. God sees me as a sinful soul, and he rebukes me, and he condemns me, and he forgives me as long as it takes. He lifts me up and carries me as long as I'm willing to participate in this plan. I may disappoint myself. I may run out of patience with myself. But God continues to love. God continues to be patient with us. Forgiving and forgiving and forgiving again. What a marvelous picture that is. Aren't you feeling blessed right now? If you are, in fact, a child of God. If you have been baptized. If you've been bought by the blood of Jesus Christ. Doesn't it feel marvelous to be a human being? To be capable of such utter depravity and yet capable of faith to the point where you can lift yourself out of that, where God can lift you out of that and continue to lift you out as you continue to fall short. We stand condemned, but we stand forgiven. Now take God out of that. If God is not part of this, then who's to say who's right and who's wrong? Who's to say who's good and who's bad? Who's to say Slade Overton was the bad guy? Who's to say Hitler was the bad guy? Who's to say Osama bin Laden was the bad guy? Your judgment is just as good as mine, just as bad as mine, just as bad as theirs. If God is not, in fact, better than me, if there is not a moral, holy God out there passing judgment, then nobody else is either. Then we have an entire culture, an entire society full of self-righteous people, people who cannot possibly be condemned of sin because there's no such thing as sin anymore. Because of that, I become infallible. There's nothing I can possibly do that's wrong because I'm doing what I want to do, and that is the measure of righteousness. My own will, my own beliefs. And since I always abide by my own will, there's nothing you can say to me. It'll tell me I'm a bad... Have you ever tried doing this to a person who doesn't have any regard for God? You really shouldn't be doing that. You really shouldn't be drinking and driving. You really shouldn't be beating your child. You really shouldn't be whatever. Who are you to say that? Isn't that what they usually say in those words? Who are you to tell me how to live my life? And the answer, of course, is I'm not anybody. God is. God's somebody. God can tell us how to live our lives. But if you don't believe in God, then what is there? I become infallible. I become incapable of growth. I cannot possibly be a better person than I am right now because I'm never going to change. I'm never going to change because I don't want to change. I don't feel any need to change. This is something that just... I can talk about Christians and growing too. I'm not going to do this. But this is one of the things that really, really gets under my skin. People who are just determined not to grow, who have no interest in learning, who have no interest in self-examination, who have already decided how they're going to live their life, and that's it. They're done. They're 24 years old, and they're master of the universe. We live in a society of these people. And it's frustrating, it's aggravating, it's maddening, it's sickening. As long as it's the other people. Now, if it's me, well, that's different. Because I'm the one that's right. They're all idiots. How can you not have a culture that is eaten up with depravity and evil, where rules are being made up on the spot, changing with the changing of the wind? No one is ever accountable for anything because nobody ever makes any mistakes. Didn't it sound familiar? Sound like what you saw in your neighborhood this week, what you saw in the news. This is the world we're living in, and this is why we're living in it. Now, I'm not sure there's all that much. Bad news first. I'm not sure there's all that much that you can do about that. You can try. I encourage you to try. And certainly we can be salt in the earth and light in the world. We can do what we can do, whatever that may be, to influence people, to help them realize the consequences of their choices and get them to reevaluate things. But even more important than that, I'm not just speaking to some person out there in the world who might have stumbled into the house here today. I'm talking to Christians. Christians, you know, decades old Christians. Examine your life. Examine your priorities. Examine your influences. What is driving you in this life? If you can live in the fear of God on an ongoing basis, if you can always trust in Him, if you can always see yourself accountable to Him, then you will inevitably and invariably be led along His paths. Go where He is trying to take you. You will be better off for it. Your family will be better off for it. You will grow. You will develop and become more and more holy, more and more righteous, more and more like Jesus Christ Himself. And in the end, go to heaven. That's the fate that you are assigning yourself when you choose to live in the fear of God. But it's not just a matter of whether you get to the church house on Sunday morning. It's a matter of whether every single hour of every single day you are acknowledging the presence of God, the sovereignty of God, the reality of God, the morality of God, the judgment of God. Not just on Sundays. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Except in leap year, it's 366. Every single hour of every single day, live with God in your focus. Live with God in your heart. And allow Him to direct you in the path that He is trying to take you, rather than the path, a very different path, by the way, that the world is trying to take you. We urge you to make your life right with God in whatever way may be necessary. I don't know where your standing is right now. I don't know what your relationship is with God right now, but it may be very well that you are not right, that you are struggling with your faith, you're struggling with your life. God has not been a constant presence in your life, in your heart, and you want help with that. And if that is the case, we urge you to respond to the Lord's invitation, to accept His will for your life, accept His punishment if that's necessary, accept His chastening, and accept our love, accept our mercy, accept our help. That includes and particularly includes those who may need to be baptized in water for remission of sins. If you have not put Jesus on in baptism, you have not entered into the life that God has always predetermined for you to live, Why not start now? Why not begin this very day to live the life that you were born to live? If there's anything we can do to help you in a spiritual regard, please respond while we stand and sing to encourage you.